Bede Noonan, welcome to Inside Infrastructure. Thank you very much for taking the time to sit down with us today. We're looking back through your story about where you got to where you are today. A pretty unique trajectory that you've been through, potted history as your father's firm started in the 70s, yourself and your brother took over, and now you're CEO of Acciona Australia, part of a fairly substantial international business. Maybe you could tell us a bit more detail that story of where it started and where you are today.
Thanks, Adrian, and good afternoon. Great to be here, and it's an honour to be invited to say a few words, have a chat. My background, we were talking off air before about how old we are, and we don't like to declare that, but I was born only a few years before my father started in business. So he started in 1972. But classic small business, family business with another partner, and largely in the geotechnical contracting side of infrastructure and building. Our growing up was a lot of holidays going to different infrastructure construction sites, largely dams being built in various parts of Australia. I was just chatting with our project director on Western Harbour Tunnel only a few hours ago, who worked on Warragamba, and he asked me about Warragamba Dam, and I said, I remember going to Warragamba Dam in about 1983 because Geotech were working there, and Dad was renting a house for our workers, and it was school holidays and the workers didn't be there. So, of course, that was where we had our holidays that year, driving up from Melbourne. Travelling around construction sites. And back then, of course, as a young kid, going on a construction site was different to now. We could jump on machinery and, safety wasn't quite what it is today. It was a lot of fun, and probably got that whole industry into our veins. So, one of six kids, and the second youngest, and my brother Andre, our chief operating officer, is the youngest of the family. Whilst I was in and around the business, probably wasn't in my trajectory to go into construction or infrastructure or engineering.
I did, because your degree wasn't.
No, I did arts economics at university. I actually majored in French. I don't speak French anywhere near as well as I used to. In fact, I don't speak French at all at the moment. But I'd like to get back into being able to speak French. I haven't picked up Spanish either. Yeah, which I should. Lack of discipline. I enjoyed schooling in Melbourne and uni, and then travelled quite a bit for a couple of years. I travelled around Australia. And that was probably the time where I sort of got a bit of a feel for the industry, because just jumped in a car with two mates, travelled around Australia and had to get some work because we had no money. So knocked on doors, got a job in Kalgoorlie working for a drilling and blasting company, got a ticket to do blasting. A lot of that was just labouring wheelbarrows and shovelling in open pit gold mines, but then a bit of drilling. Travelled to the Northern Territory, got a job at Tanami Gold Mine, flying in and out of Darwin. So that was a huge changing year for me when I was 20 years old, 20, 21. And, got in with working people, really, worked out how to survive, how to love it, how to enjoy, being in the outside in that work environment. So, fantastic. Also enjoyed drilling holes, which was surprising because their company had been drilling holes for years, but I'd never operated a drill rig. I worked out I wasn't much good at it, but I could actually put a hole in the ground where it was pretty easy. So that was pretty formative. I went overseas for a year and travelled around Europe and so forth after that, but then came back and the firm, Dad and his partner's company, did an accountant, joined us as a company accountant in 1993. And of course, small business, probably five professional staff, another 30, construction workers, drillers, grouting, specialist sort of work. And you did a bit of everything. The accounting meant you did the payroll, accounts payable, bank, everything. You dealt with the fact that you had no money and you diced everything out accordingly, but also went on projects and started to understand project management. Started developing systems, quality assurance systems, and so forth. So that was an incredible time in a small business, small, medium-sized business, most of our clients were, you know, John Holland, Thies, Abbey Group, Balderstone, and then, you know, you built relationships, worked on projects like Melbourne City Link in the late 90s and many of the people like the Jason Spears.
When you say worked on, this is in the ground.
In the ground, yeah. You know,
piling and, I don't know, the
technical anchoring terms. Yeah, hold back anchors and, yeah. Both, well, I personally at that stage wasn't, although occasionally I'd jump in and weirdly, as you're doing small businesses back then, you can get in and do labouring. Not so much now, but yeah, very much hands-on, small contracts, small subcontracts on major projects, and very hands-on, and built enormous relationships with people. We have people, in fact, Fraser Ramsey was a project engineer for Transfield WRSU Joint Venture. He was our client, as was Jason Spears. Jason's now CEO of CPB. Fraser is our Executive General Manager of Southwest Region for Acciona. And many other people like that. So that was incredible. Circumstances then led Andre and myself and another employee to make a buyout for Dad and Jeff's company in 2000, turning over about $5 million a year, which was, you know, a big bite for us. We did that transaction. I also bought a concrete spraying company a year or two before that. So we're on a bit of a journey, started like you do when you're young and you own a business. Fear of failure is probably the biggest thing you drive you, and you're knowing you've got to put employing people, paying wages every week, a real driver of how to find work, how to get work. And as a result, you know, you go from $5 million turnover to $30 million turnover. We had no business plans, but we you know, had to stay alive and find work to do. We worked.
Was that your aspiration though? Did you think like, we want to take this thing that's been steady state and grow it bigger as a survival?
No, certainly it was survival. It was survival. Yeah, there was. You have circumstances which help you along. Melbourne City Link, with all of the work that had to happen there, some people might remember the Burnley Tunnel. They just about opened it and then they found enormous structural problems and water problems, and we went in there and did, you know, we went from $5 million revenue to $20 million revenue in 1 year with just a massive amount of work. Hands-on 24 hours a day for about probably a year. And that was all hands on deck. We went to Thredbo after the Thredbo landslides, where you might recall that event in 2001, I think it was, and did a lot of work up in the Snowy Mountains for that kind of stuff. So, you know, I've got enormous affection and respect for small and medium businesses, because I know how hard you have to work, how hand to mouth you are, compared to, you know, we have different pressures as bigger businesses now, but you know, the reality and the day-to-day pressures of small and medium businesses is something that we grew up with, and so yeah, we took it on from there, and it's been a pretty good and interesting journey. We've done a couple of good things,
but you know, getting it from a position of being 20 employees to something that's 500 employees, there's got to be more than a fear of failure in the building of that business and adjacencies. Like what drove you through that, you know, and why you and Andre, as opposed to like, what are your other siblings doing? Are they in construction as well? Did they join you on the journey in any way?
My older brother Justin had a very large concrete placement company in Melbourne, largely in the vertical building market. He was very successful, ended up selling that company and has actually worked with us, but never in an ownership structure, just for a small period of time. My three sisters, my elder sister went to Germany. She's an architect and went to Germany, so she was probably the most adventurous of us all. Still lives in Munich and married there and went there because there was no work in the late 90s, recession, having finished uni. And so she's a great place to go and visit every year and a good excuse to have a relative over there. And then my other two sisters have done various things in a bit entrepreneurial, had a few businesses, but not in our sector. So, and you know, how it worked, I suppose, to some, life is a bit about a bit of good luck, a bit of good positioning, and then hard work and taking advantage of opportunities, I suppose. Mm. So yeah, we I think more than anything else, when you start off though, and well, I was probably 30 back then, and you know, you've got a few kids, and you've got to keep your family, you've got to keep your employees, and you work at it. It's an incredibly good grounding, because we were doing everything from paying wages, running the payroll ourselves, developing a payroll system software, which actually today is still the foundation for Acciona's payroll system, what we wrote back in 1994. Incredibly good bit of software, which is enormously more sophisticated now, but the philosophy of it and the philosophy of business systems now go back to what we learnt and what I believe is the right way to run a business. And to have people who understand each part of business, as opposed to, I think large companies get a very silo mentality. I do this, commercial do that, procurement do that, IT do that. Small businesses, all of those things have to get done. They're just done by one person, the owner, or a small number of people who are the leaders. And so that approach is what I believe is the right way. In fact, I think you see that just about all the major software companies in the world take that approach: build teams, make them as self-sufficient as possible, and let them go. I have a view that that's a much better way to operate. I think it's much more empowering, and it comes from that background of believing that actually people can do things themselves. And as big businesses, yes, we need governance. All businesses need governance. What effectively you do when you grow from a small business of 30 employees to 4,500 employees is you work on building your systems and processes to accommodate the governance requirements as you grow. You can't impose what we have now on something that's half its size or a quarter of its size, but you develop it.
That brings us to the journey from $5 million a year revenue to $280 million a year revenue. 2017 rocks around and there's a phone call, Spanish accent on the other end of the line, from Madrid, and says, "B, we want in." Talk us what happens then. I know it didn't happen quite like that. But
it wasn't quite like that, but okay. we'd had a private equity firm. It was Tanara Capital, which started life as Carnegie Wiley, which was Mark Carnegie and John Wiley, who were very well-known characters in the Australian financial industry, both good fellows. And John's still a mate of mine. I don't see Mark much, but he's a lovely bloke, though. That was a great journey, and they also introduced us to Dieter at AMSIS. And Dieter is an absolute legend of the industry, having been the chief financial officer for Leighton Holdings and right-hand man with Wal King, and built, you know, Leighton's from a $300 million market cap to a $16 billion market cap when he retired. So he was our chairman, and came into a highly unsophisticated company in about 2008, 2009, and helped us on our journey. And Tanara, Carnegie Wiley Tanara, were also very supportive. They were a private equity there for about 10 years, and they needed an exit. And so we explored that exit. And we had a very large Chinese, government-owned Chinese company, very interested, as well as Acciona. There were a few others, but they really came down.
Was that like an open sale?
Yep.
Process?
Yeah, it was we had PwC assisting and ran a global process and came down to a shortlist and then came down to a final two, got into very serious negotiations with both. I went to Beijing four times and they came out. It was a very difficult time. It was actually very interesting going to Beijing and it was also that time where President Xi was in and you could see literally over the 12 months when I was dealing with this company, you could see the Chinese impact and how psychologically it was impacting. It got to the point of us feeling very comfortable with this company to feeling this is not going to work. They had their passports taken off them. They were initially could come out, managers, you understood who was who, to a point where they weren't allowed to travel. So that was literally happened over 12 months in 2016. So at the same time, we were visiting Spain and interacting with Acciona.
And Acciona were already in this market?
Operating already in it, yeah. They had a number of projects, including Sydney Light Rail. We were actually a subcontractor on Sydney Light Rail to do the rail work. We were actually having disagreements with Athiona on that project, which were challenging. But notwithstanding that, it was immediately clear, and even when we were dealing with them on Sydney Light Rail as a subcontractor, the leadership, very, very good people. It sounds like a trite sort of statement, but a way of describing someone. Honest, genuine people. If you're having a disagreement with someone, but you fundamentally believe they're a good person coming from a good place, you can work on it and you can deal with it. That's not always the case, but generally the case in my perspective. So yeah, we had terrific time in Madrid. We struck up very strong personal relationships. And clearly that also was reciprocated because, you know, as I think back, whilst we're a business owner, we're trying to get a very strong value both for ourselves and our other shareholders. Mm. When I think about it now, I go, wow, what a risk. You know, they were paying a hell of a lot of money of goodwill for a couple of rat bags from Melbourne. who at that stage had sort of come up through the ranks, but really.
It's even worse than that, though, because they let you retain some ownership.
They forced
the business
us to.
As well. Yeah. So they forced you. So that
they wouldn't buy without us retaining 20%. So that wasn't the original plan. And, and so that had to be worked through, and that required then a shareholders agreement and how to actually operate together. So that was it took a long time to get everything negotiated, yeah.
With hindsight, you think that was the right decision
100%.
From them and your perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. In hindsight for them, it couldn't have worked.
So do you think that as that ownership stake that the family has changes the behaviour of the company relative to...
Absolutely. There's no doubt. There's no doubt they've got a incredibly long-term view, a very person-orientated perspective on everything all of the time. Having said that, I come from a position where I don't have a lot of other experience with other companies, right? So I can't tell you how it is to work in another company. I've worked in Geotech and I've worked in Athiona, but that's what I feel. That's what I, I know the family there of the extended family, weddings, funerals. So there's a very much a, and that's isn't without its challenges. You know, it's not that easy dealing with family. I know it myself in business. You know, it's not without its challenges, but on balance, I think it's a very nice environment to be in. Yeah,
there's been subsequent acquisitions as well.
Yeah,
so it's not just organic growth since Fiona took over. There's been purchases of other portfolios. So, what does the business look like now?
Yeah, well, we had the Lendlease Engineering, which was the old Abbey Group from Balderstone, which was great. Amazing. That's just transformed. It probably accelerated where we us by at least 5 years, and we're sitting here almost 5 years now. And there's no way we'd be where we were. Perhaps we would have been. We were probably about $1 billion revenue. We're now at 4.5. That was a terrific, great transaction. I mean, right place, right time for us. I'd seen Steve McCann. I went and approached him before they announced it, about 3 months before. I could sort of smell that things weren't good. They'd made a lot of write downs. And then negotiating through that over 6 or 9 months. I'm fortunate I'd been, I've bought 8 companies actually over 15 years. So a lot smaller than that, but
all of them successful? As in
I've had to shut one down.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've had one company that I had to shut down, which was a real shame, but we blew probably $30 million back in 2012 on an acquisition, 2012-13, but we shut it down. No one lost any money. We lost money. No other party lost money. I've seen, we've had some failures, one failure, but... So then the Lend Lease was great working through how to do that from our perspective. Clearly, the market at that stage, there were no real foreign companies in the market. I think the issue with the Chinese economy and, the Chinese geopolitical situation was very difficult too, so that was challenging for anyone else. And Lendlease were in a situation where they'd publicly declared they had to sell non-core. So really right place, right time. And it was amazing to see incredibly long-term employees just really wanting and crying out for someone to wrap their arms around them, to be a construction company, to get back to their roots, to feel good about who they were. That business was already a very good business, but it had a small number of bad projects, but those bad projects were big bad projects. But the rest of the business was in good shape.
If you look across the Australian infrastructure pipeline, there's been a real switch over in the last couple of years away from what's been a huge suite of very complex mega transport projects into a slew of smaller but, quite complex renewables, et cetera. How has the portfolio within Acciona changed as the market's changed in Australia?
Yes, well, we're fortunate that we have transitioned quite significantly.
You were fairly early on in that.
Yeah, we were, and I suppose to some extent we're a bit blessed because we have Acciona's got Acciona Energía, which is a energy developer, largely wind farms in particular. Mm-hmm. So we'd already done, as a construction company here in Australia, we'd built the a small wind farm in Victoria. And we have been building the McIntyre wind farm with them for probably about 3 years now. And that sort of knowledge of the coming from the energy business has been very helpful for us. Mm-hmm. The project down in Victoria, we built a small but still a high voltage transmission line to connect to the grid. So then thinking about and looking ahead at transmission was important for us. How to do that was important. Again, I think a lot about how we're structured. I'm always cautious about bureaucracy and building too much overhead, and I like accountability and simplicity. So we didn't actually build a business arm in transmission lines, but we took a very conscious position of recruiting some people and building capability and still keeping it within our state-based business there. And so we've been picked up two very significant transmission lines in the Central West Orana and then half of the Humelink project, and obviously Victoria now in the procurement phases. Things happening over in Western Australia. We have probably about 30% of our forward pipeline. We've got about 15 billion work in hand. So I think about 20% of that is energy sector. Mm-hmm. But of our pipeline of tenders, it's somewhere in the region of 50 to 60% now. It's renewable energy or transmission lines. So that's been a change, very, very rapid change that's occurred.
So that'll be a pretty substantial remaking of the business then from being transport civils led for like that whole journey you spoke about, the strategic context to that was massive increase in government transport spend in effect. We're probably at the top of that wave now. The energy is coming, but you're geared up to deliver all these big transport civil projects. How do you change the business so it can deliver all of that energy stuff?
From a management perspective, the disciplines separate from the technical side of it are the same. So the costing systems, the processes that we have. Different group of clients. So, the EnergyCo in New South Wales have built themselves a business from people who have come from transport, added in energy professionals, no doubt, but significant number of people that are known to us. And then building up a relationship with Transgrid, and some of the people, quite a few of their people actually, are civil construction people that some of them used to work for us and people in the industry, so that's been good. And then you think about there's quite a lot of discipline, you know, temporary road work that has to go in, the civil work for the pads, the camps and so forth. And then we've got a mechanical business. I mean, one of the businesses we bought in 2006 was a mechanical business in Victoria. So we have built substations on a smaller scale. We have all the steel work for the towers. That's familiar work. Stringing is something that's not. We actually put a strategic agreement in place with a company called Genus, which is a listed company here in Australia, about 3.5 years ago. They are specialty in that space, and we thought let's make sure that they can't do all our work, or they might be able to do a significant part depending on what else is going on. But we want to actually leverage off that, and we see, I think, especially coming that from my smaller business background, I think we overdo the concern about skills. It's amazing how quickly small and medium sized business can move.
Mm.
Mm.
I mean, our role is to get out of their way, right?
Yeah.
So, yes, there are some really specialist skills, but on Arana and HumeLink, of the people we need, it's be less than 10% are highly specialist skills that you have to train for and build up, as opposed to stuff that you can transfer into.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Are there other areas of the supply chain that need to develop quickly, correspondingly, in the way that skills would have to? And I guess I ask that with a view to, you know, this switch towards onshoring, like what's the importance of that to the level of activity you have going in energy and renewables at the moment?
Yeah, look, I think so. Well, the impact for renewables and these projects on roads and communities is very interesting. I mean, and government's looking at that in ports and bringing stuff in. And that's something that we're looking at. Weirdly even looked at those helium balloons.
Yes.
You know, okay, what are they
the
called? That was an idea that came. And maybe that's an idea because someone else is doing it.
People laugh at that. I think like, it's the right solution as long as there's no public sector money.
I just won't be standing under it, that's all. You know, it's just...
Yeah, like if someone's prepared to take a risk on it, just give it a go. Sorry.
No, that's all right. That's all right. Well, I mean, as an example, alongside Athiona Energy here, we built or sort of saw an idea and developed it a bit further with the blades, transport of the blades. Yeah. And having lying down, we've got this blade lifter that holds it sitting up. And so just thinking
like
about
your turning angles.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's
right. Yeah. And so that just changes your geometry of the temporary road, well, not temporary road, permanent roads, but they're all, you know, that you've got to do. Changes how many trees you have to cut down.
Yes. Yeah.
That'll be the same with transmission lines. How we go about building them within our context will be different. So that's another reason for the consideration of coming together with some, like we've come with Cobra. They've got a much more experience in transmission lines than Acciona. But the Australian thinking about how we're going to build stuff is so necessary. And we're thinking, number one, the cost of labour here is probably about 100 times higher than Cobra's used to. Perhaps not, at least 50 times higher.
Mm.
That impacts every single thing and the methodology you go about.
Yeah.
Right? Because whether you use a helicopter, a drone, or a crane, or a, you know, I know that if you're sitting on a site and you're sitting with a crane, two cranes, a drill rig, da da da, that's $100,000 a day of cost sitting there.
Mm.
In another jurisdiction, it's $5,000.
Yeah,
that will impact whether you go about it that way or don't go about it that way, and the industrial relations landscape will impact those sort of decisions. So you know, that it's a really interesting. To work through those methodology when you get here, people say, no, you do it this way. How about we have a think about what are we up against here? Because we will have a site where a farmer's not happy and that transmission line stops. And not only that, all weather, right? And something, right? So do you want $200,000 a day of cost sitting there doing nothing and you're not unable to move it for 3 months? Imagine that.
Yeah.
And I just go, that can't happen.
Yeah, but it does.
Just wait.
The other thing that's striking to me that's different from the last 15 years is that, well, I mean, I can hear construction noise in the background here. We're by Sydney Light Rail. a stone's throw from here, you're doing Western Harbour Tunnel, West Connect. The same's true in Melbourne, Brisbane. It's been super concentrated on metro areas. So there will be people in the civil construction industry who have been able to live in the same house, in the same suburb, take their kids to soccer at the weekend and move from project to project. But all the stuff we're talking about now, or a big majority of the stuff, is hundreds of kilometres away in all different directions. So how do you think we tackle not just the skills, but the people getting them there? How's that going to play out?
Yeah, well, it's a real change. There's no doubt about it. I mean, at this stage, the New South Wales transmission lines, Humelink and Orana, are not too far away. You know, they're 2 hours, not 10 hours, by car. So, but you still got to live locally. You're not going to live in Sydney and commute. So, absolutely, and that's a real issue for your interaction with the local society. Mm. It's a significant issue at Orana. You've got that social impact. Not just our transmission line. You've got all of the other solar and wind farms, mainly wind and batteries that are going to be built out there. You'll probably get up to a peak workforce in 3 years in the region of well over 3,000 construction workers.
And it'd be a region with below national average unemployment. I mean, national average is about 4%, so it'd be lower than 2% probably. Yeah.
And they're concerned about primary schools, doctors. They're locals, right? So it's all very well. But our 3,000 construction workers, we would like a lot of them to live there. You know, there's going to be camps, but there's still going to be impacts on the local infrastructure, be it schools, be it doctors, be it whatever. So that's all being thought through, and it's not that people aren't just arriving there without having went through that. So significant impacts. But getting back to your workforce issue, it's not that nothing will happen here, but there's definitely going to be a change, and that will be good for some people and other people won't like it as much. Surprisingly resilient. I don't worry too much about that. I mean, if it was 15 hours away and when it gets to that sort of stuff and if you need thousands of people, that's a lot more challenging. I mean, I hope that we're not just a fly-in, fly-out environment.
Yeah.
So I think what I see on the East Coast, I think is achievable, and I think it's achievable on a people that can have the option of living in a camp or relocating a family there. If you think about it, if you're 28, 30, married, got two kids, you get the opportunity to go and live in a country town, minimum 3-5 years, that can be very appealing for someone.
Are you going to have to pay a premium for people to do that?
We will. Yeah, they'll earn a project premium.
Yeah.
And they'll live in an environment which is probably cheaper than what it is here.
And they've got some lovely towns, actually.
Some beautiful. Oh, absolutely. Beautiful. Sensational. So, yeah.
I imagine that's part of the challenge, right, that you've actually got conflict with potentially properties that would be used for tourism and for other, for other economic purposes. And I think that switch you'll see in those regional communities, it does challenge their existing 100%. Economies and their existing social structures to bring in 3,000, 4,000 construction workers. Are there things that you think companies, governments, others need to be doing in those communities to keep that social license and to support that transition? Because it's quite obviously the transition is a benefit to us all, but it's actually got quite acute local impacts within some communities.
Mm. Yeah, well, there's a incredibly noticeable difference in the psychology of locals when they are actually talking to people who are going to be building directly. And that's no disrespect to the procurement side of things, but it's like finally speaking to someone who can tell me what's going on. The earlier that can happen, the better. We're doing it in Victoria now, and we're not even selected, but just a few different consortiums, and it's just palpable the difference when you see farmers worried about how something is going to occur. They're talking to the people who are going to be building it. They sort of go to the you just be quiet for a minute. I want to talk to this person. And also the more that we can talk in a manner that we are actually telling them this is how we plan to do it, not I think we'll do this, or maybe, you know. Yeah. They really, the relief that washes over is quite amazing.
Truth abhors a vacuum, and when the public sector comes along and says, "Well, it's a corridor; it's going to be somewhere within this 5 kilometer zone." Of course, 98% of the people in there are annoyed about something that's actually only going to affect the 2%, but you don't know which 2% it is.
And so I'm not in any way disparaging the procurement agencies. Because I think it's just
reality.
It's just is what it is. I would just say it's a reason to get involved with construction people as early as you possibly can, because that social license piece really relies on it.
So, talking about construction people and the broader construction industry, if we'd been having this conversation 4 or 5 years ago, I think you'd be leading fairly hard with the industry's in tough shape. There's been risks we've taken that we shouldn't have, risks we've been forced to take that we shouldn't have. What's the health of the industry like now? Where are we on the journey?
I think there are some in much better shape than others. From our perspective, we're in good shape. We have, as I said, about $15 billion of work in hand. I think of that, 80%, 70 to 80% of that are relationship contracts. So alliances, incentivized target costs, contracts where ourselves and our client are significantly aligned, have different models of how closely we actually work together. Some of those, you know, we still stand alone, but the nature of the contract and the openness of it ensures that we're working close together. We're finding those to be very successful. I think there are still some others who, again, a bit of luck, perhaps a little bit of good management. We probably didn't win after 2000 Lend-Lease Engineering. We didn't really win much in 2021 and 2022, and I think it's been a bit of a challenge for some of the contracts that were won in that period of time because of the inflation impacts that have occurred and the challenges that have then gone about. We were sort of more aware in 2023, so we've been a little bit lucky in one respect from a timing perspective. And I suspect there are definitely some challenging contracts that are still that are around from there. And I believe that I think there are probably some challenges where I don't think government has properly appreciated what is it they're buying. And I don't think as construction companies we've done a good enough job in explaining what is it about Athiona or whomever you are. If you're just being lined up and there's no differentiation, that feels to me like a lot of government procurement is like that. A lot of it is give us your marketing spiel, how good you are. Okay, you shouldn't need that. Like, you guys are sophisticated, most of you. Well, when I say that, I don't mean to be disparaging. I mean from the point of view of how often they're procuring. Why do you need us to market to you to tell you how good we are? Like, it's marketing our own homework. And then the challenges I feel are around, you know, where we are now didn't come about in 5 minutes, as we spoke about before. It's like 5 million to 300 million to billion to 4.5 billion. Overnight success that's just taken 25 years and building up all, you know, 250 million of overhead a year that, you know, I'm sitting in our mentoring program, you know, 40 people in a mentoring program in Athiona, or development programs of people from Perth to Auckland. And my other major competitors in CPB and John Holland, I know we've got similar sort of programs. And then tiers of others like Langer Rourke and BMD. There are serious time, effort, money goes into how we go about our business. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there are some agencies that where some of the challenging contracts are that I don't think have in any way taken that into account or understand. And that's our responsibility. I think we've done a poor job as construction companies as to what is it that we bring to the table as Athiona as opposed to, oh yeah, I've built a train line in Mozambique once, or whatever it might be. There's too much concentration on experience and not enough concentration on competence.
A couple of years back, there was a lot of talk about the profitless boom.
Yeah.
And that's sort of gone quiet now. Has there been a maturing in the market? Like, what changed really from that point till now?
I think the Australian Contractors Association, the push, has actually borne a lot of fruit. We're quite happy with our portfolio of projects and the risk there. And that's understandable that's where the market goes when there's pain and it bounces back. Getting an equilibrium that works is important. And I think, absolutely, government don't want it either. It's not deliberate that things get to bad. But then you do get the agencies who have to deliver it. They don't want to be in projects that are in pain and difficult and prolonged and so forth. So in my experiences, the leaders all want similar things, but they've all got different constraints, understandably, from a governance perspective, from a treasury perspective, in how to get there. So definitely it's a far better place.
Do you think it's a better place for taxpayers?
I think it's moving that way. There's no doubt that we can do and drive enormous efficiency into this industry. The challenge, I believe, that our infrastructure, most major infrastructure, is bespoke. We would like to try and make it less bespoke, and transmission lines are a great opportunity to make something less bespoke. And it will go that way, absolutely. We're working heavily on that, and others, I'm sure, are also. But, you know, a tunnel, Western Harbour Tunnel, that's bespoke, right? It's every part of it. You learn from other staff and you bring in mechanicals and so forth. How to arrive at a price, how to get that time right, how to deal with it, you know, if you think that you can just buy that on lump sum, you know, and I think everyone's being a bit crazy. Mm. Someone's going to win big and someone's going to lose big. For it to be correct is almost impossible. So I think the challenge has been Treasury getting your head around the idea of procurement and what is value for money and how do we get there. And then the real final piece is enabling us to innovate, because the tighter the contract, the less we can innovate. And that's something the Treasury don't really see, because they're not really involved in that. Huge amount of money. If you think Spain tunnel in Spain is probably about 25% of the cost of a tunnel here, or most infrastructure.
Mm.
Now, a little bit of that is labour cost, probably 20% of it. The rest of it is just, let's get out of the way a lot of the stuff we do. We design management, design process, is definitely 5 to 10 times longer here than it should. What takes a year should only take 2 months, maybe 1 month. Literally, that's the sort of saving. It's huge. And that is not going to happen in a step.
Mm.
But we're seeing iterative change to that effect. We're seeing governments agencies being prepared to say, I'll cut the design review from 4 to 3. I'll think about what's a risk management approach to saying, what do I really need to concentrate on instead of doing that? It's slow, but there's genuine leadership in that happening, which is going to allow us to innovate more, as opposed to we can't afford to because it takes too much time to change someone's mind.
Mm. So I agree with a lot of that, particularly on the procuring for an outcome rather than hyper-specificity on exactly what it is the government's buying, because it gives you the freedom to innovate. But one of the counterpoint arguments we can very simplistically say, well, the Treasuries need to get a better idea of what value for money means rather than lowest price. But they would also argue a fixed price contract puts certain disciplines around an outcome. It puts a discipline on government that it can't change halfway through, whereas perhaps in some of the alliances it's a bit easier to say, actually, I don't like the colour of the walls, I want them different. And obviously there's a role for all of these models. Do you think pendulum was too far one way and is now too far the other, or are we sort of lazily using one type of procurement model rather than aligning stuff properly to the needs of a specific project? Is it about right?
I don't know. I mean, if you're building apartments, I mean, just about every single apartment contract for a developer is lump sum. But it's very well known. It's the risks are low, although a lot of builders worked out the risk of hyperinflation. They just couldn't believe that that could happen, and a lot of them went broke as a result. Industrial relations is an inherent risk, but not a lot of ground engineering risk, and not a lot of construction efficiency risk and how to build it. So the more you know and you more have certainty, the more you can go lump sum. There's no doubt about it. The challenge is the difficulty of managing all the different elements when you are not certain of everything. And we're now in a world where stakeholder management is an incredibly important part of a project. Whether we like it or not, we're in democracy, and it's appropriate. And politicians, you know, whilst they won't, they will interfere. And they won't interfere directly. They won't. I'm not suggesting there's anything corrupt or inappropriate, but if taxpayers are concerned about something, politicians are going to be concerned about it. That's actually what we want in society. And so,
I'm going to go out on a limb and say I quite like democracy.
Absolutely.
It'll be controversial, but
So, the notion that you can have a project that sits there and it's actually in the public eye and it's in the middle of George Street and that can be lump sum and there's no, it's not the government's project.
But hear me out here. Absolutely, I agree that we're in a democracy, and I don't want infrastructure decisions to be made by someone in the depths of a bureaucracy. I want a politician to be there so I can sack them if they get it wrong. However, the politician needs to have discipline around them as well. And if I consider some of maybe the PPPs or the fixed price contracts, it's an incentive framework around a project that limits the politician's capacity to come along and say, actually, I want another station because it's expensive for them to do it. It can't be smushed over under the contract. It's transparent. Do you think there's like an element of kind of the counterfactual that's hard to see?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll give you an example. I think the opportunity, and I spoke before about the transmission lines and renewable energy projects and society, right? And when we go in and we're talking directly to people in the community, when they're talking to the constructor, it's a whole different ballgame, right? So whether we like it or not, you've got to get these projects through planning, environmental approvals, and as they're more rural, they've got to also get, you know, buy-in from, they're going to face community resistance. So the longer you leave the constructor, the worse. The second part is it's amazing how much we can impact the price. So McIntyre Wind Farm for Acciona Energía, they went through and did the full design and layout, including the roads, and then they did traditional procurement, right? And then we were able to get in there and save about $100 million, but we could have saved $250 million for our own company. See, but you couldn't because they'd already done planning and approval and so forth.
Yeah.
So we've got the tools to be able to do that because we've got they just go to consultants and they just say, where's the best wind? Boom, right. And we are now talking to a range of wind developers and offering notes that say, and they go, we need that. Because actually we want certainty in cost, especially in an environment where they've seen projects fail, constructors fail. Whether you like... The truth is, I think most people in the industry, especially investors, have gone past the notion of, I don't care, sign this contract and you just do it, especially when they go, I've just been involved in two projects where I've lost my equity.
Yeah. We have conveniently, as if it was planned that way, arrived at productivity and efficiency.
Both really wanted to talk about.
Do you want to go first or should I? Well,
I mean, why don't you start? But I definitely think like you're touching on those points around efficiency and innovation and where in the process to get that efficiency, I think is the perfect setup for your question, your next question.
I spend a bit of time talking to politicians, all sides of politics. I talk a lot to industry. I talk a lot to public service. And everybody wants to talk about productivity in construction. And that's about the depth of it. People don't dive deeper. They just say, well, this is expensive. You know, tunnels in Madrid cost 25% of what they cost in Sydney, or Melbourne or Brisbane. How do we make them cheaper? And it just doesn't seem like a very sophisticated discussion to me. So a small question, how do we make it more productive?
And also, do you agree with that, isn't it? Because it seems to be a continuous refrain that construction is not a productive or highly innovative industry. And, you know, if you look at the headline stats, you know, construction is 3% less productive than it was in 1990. And
spoiler alert, I think that's complete bull.
Well, I think obviously the figure averages out a lot. And so there's some wide, you know, wide bookends. But, you know, what do you see? Where are the opportunities for productivity across the board?
It's all in white collar. It's got nothing to do with blue collar. I'm a massive believer that workforce good, our subcontractors are good. We just need to give them the opportunity. They naturally want to go hard. They naturally want to. It's just a natural human condition.
It's also,
and yes, we do have industrial relations issues, and you know, there are absolutely huge opportunities to sort that out and have environments that are much better. But as an example, Central Tunnelling Package, Melbourne Metro, we finished the tunnelling there late last year, which was incredibly successful. 7 kilometres of dual tunnel from Rozelle out to Sydney Olympic Park. Productivity on the concrete sections for the tunnel lining, we got down to an average of less than 4 minutes a panel. Now, that is coming down from where the industry was at about 6 minutes, only about 3 or 4 years ago. That's very, very significant improvement in productivity. Piling, we've got probably the biggest piling company in Australia is our piling business. I see it every day. We are hugely investing. We've got we've got a couple of old rigs, but most of them on average would be 2 years old. And the equipment now and the rate that we're putting piles in the ground is just phenomenally quicker. That is so much more efficient than they were. So your point that you said you don't believe it, I agree. I don't. Productivity, how do you measure productivity on bespoke projects one to another? However, undoubtedly our productivity is nowhere near what it should be. So we can argue about whether it's high, low, whether it's zero,
but
negative.
My contention is that we misdiagnose the problem, and therefore we prescribe the wrong solution, or we don't prescribe a solution because we're misdiagnosing it and actually it's something entirely else. So I go onto a construction site today. I'm told that in the last 30 years, productivity in construction has flatlined. In fact, the trope is that it's worse than hunting and fishing. And yet I go onto a construction site today and it looks a whole lot different to how it looked 30 years ago. It is visibly more productive, even to an untrained eye. I personally think the issue is that actually other areas of construction are measured together. So housing construction is measured with civil construction. They're different beasts, but one is, a house building site hasn't changed a great deal from 30 years ago. There's maybe a nail gun, but
differences in the structures.
I therefore think we're not concentrating on the white collar stuff where we should be looking at productivity. And instead, we're getting people sort of mired in a discussion about,
how quickly you can dig the hole.
Exactly.
It's not about that. I mean, we're smashing tunneling. Like, it's just, and we know exactly what our tunneling rates have been in the past. And that's just improving and improving our piling rates and improving our precast construction.
So, why do those measures show improvement? But I'm told productivity.
We know on our stats they are. And I'd be surprised if our competitors weren't seeing similar sort of stuff and differing, depending on what they are specialists in and what areas and their projects and so forth. But we're just continuing to see a growth in requirements and design being more and more conservative. We're seeing our project team sizes and requirements being bigger and bigger. Huge opportunity in our project teams. In our industry, basically, is it professional services. I know that some of the big accounting firms, I don't want to name names, but a couple of partners have told me that they're at about one non-billing person to every three billing. I think hospitals in Australia should be a 1 in 10, and they're about one in three or so. We've got one white collar person for every two blue collar people in Australia. My youngest son's a carpenter. He's working on residential housing sites, and I go and visit one of his jobs. It's him, and he's almost finished apprenticeship. Him and a 28-year-old building a house, a high-end house, $3 million house, managing all the trades and so forth. There's no white-collar people. Mm. None.
But do you think that the way that they're going about that job has radically shifted from how it would have been built 20 years ago?
I think we've forgotten when it comes to governance, we've been fantastic in creating processes and not thinking about what is it are we trying to solve for and how can we solve for that? Do we need to solve for it, or have we created a process for no reason?
Yeah.
And secondly, can we change that process to something? Now, I go to accounts payable. It was started by the Greeks about 5,000 years ago, and it hasn't improved. It's got worse. Yeah. I don't think in my – and I reflect on my organisation. Yes. It's a disgrace. That's no one's fault but mine.
Yeah.
Because there is that sort of argument, and it has, I think it was put, you know, in a report last year that the issue is this proliferation of a white-collar class around infrastructure. But I would have assumed that really is very confined to the really complex, really technical end of the project spectrum, whereas some of the inefficiencies that multi-factor productivity stat picks up really reflects what is, you know, you've got huge concentration at the top end, but at the bottom end, you've got a huge
Would you regard communication as being high end and technical? So some of our biggest teams are communications on projects, and some of the government requirements now don't allow us to use social media.
Yeah,
hand dropping pieces of paper in people's mailboxes still.
Yeah,
because until you can prove that you can cover that 95% of people will use social media, you're not allowed to.
Yes.
Go, come on.
Yeah.
Simple as that. So we've got 10 comms people who are doing all this stuff when we should have two.
Yes. And is that because of the complexity of the project, though?
No,
it's because community engagement or
getting client to change is really hard. And in all due respect, is the one thing I've learned, as you get bigger, it's really hard to change. Like, I used to be able to change stuff.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard to change. And that's understandable. So Transport for New South Wales is 10 times harder to change than my organisation because it's 10 times bigger. And I know people at senior levels want to change, and some of them are working towards it, but there are some areas that are just, you've got to. But the leaders have got to sing from this book in order to drive our industry's productivity. They've got to understand that it's about everyone, whether you're a lawyer, whether you're an accountant, whether you're in human resources, whether you're in communications. It's easier to think it's about digging the hole. It's not about digging the hole. It's about all of us finding a way to make it as easy as possible for the people to dig the hole. That's our role.
Yeah, I think that – so I agree with that. I just think we've calcified the problem over time and we've layered on more and more people. I think it's – you paint the picture of what it's done in your business. I think the inverse of that is the sort of person marking that then happens in the public sector.
Exactly, yeah.
That you've got, you get this kind of self-fulfilling problem where you're required to put more people on, and then they put more people on to observe what the people you've hired are doing, and we just end up with these massive entities.
Mm.
And we've probably got away from a focus of actually what's what are we buying, what's being delivered, and how are you making it easier for those people to dig the hole?
There's one other thing that I have done and would continue to message to government, because first of all, let me be very clear, I recognise that it's not just government. Like, we're not much good. None of us. You know, we've got an obligation, an absolute obligation, to push to be much more productive, to help drive it. You know, so have government. So they're equally. From a political perspective, I would like the political leaders to recognise that, because they're the ones that really have to drive that. And then secondly, with government department to government department, is a real area that causes problem and cost. And you know, I can't actually give you an example because I'm not allowed to, but I know of a glaring example that if it became public would be front page of newspapers. And it's just, can you talk to each other and get along with each other and think about the paranoia with probity and governance creating bad outcomes is not what society wants. Absolutely, we want good governance. We want things done appropriately. We don't want money ripped up. So they're not mutually exclusive concepts. We can bring them together. And that is, I, you know, if any politician is listening, state or federal.
We'll send them a copy.
I say to you, and I'd see very little of this, except in South Australia and Western Australia. They're the only two states I see this.
Well, we noticed that.
Take an interest, lean in, and take an interest in your projects, especially your main ones, right? Genuinely. Don't just turn up for photo opportunities. Take an interest, because it's the public's money that you've been represented to have some governance over. And I see so little interest from politicians in New South Wales, Victoria in particular, genuinely trying to understand how they can make and how they can lead and help without it impacting governance.
But we noticed you had said that unlocking productivity would require a rebuild of trust within the industry. Is that what you meant by it? Like that, you know, in the procurement process, there's been a scaling up of resources on both sides of the divide in order to manage for what is a lack of trust? Was that what was driving your comment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, effectively, perhaps one thing we take for granted in a country like Australia where we've got it so good is that we think that everything relies on trust. I own a house, apparently own the block of land the house sits on. It's a bit of paper. If someone invades the country, it's not mine anymore. So it's, I trust our institutions that that bit of land and the house is mine. I think it's easy to lose sight of that because we live in such a great country and haven't had the difficulties of many other places where, you know, I've got employees who come from East Germany whose parents used to own a block of land, which is no longer part of the family's property, so on and so forth. Trust is more important than the construction contract and the agreements and building those relationships so that you can. I always say, if you're concentrating on is that your risk or my risk, you're almost determined that the risk will evolve instead of concentrating on how we avoid that risk coming about.
You mentioned in your description of what we're perhaps doing wrong on productivity, you said we're very conservative in design.
Yep.
I think that probably manifests a bit around embodied carbon and the approach that people inside the bureaucracy will take to more innovative solutions around decarbonisation. I know I've heard you speak about this passionately in the past about just how much concrete and steel we're unnecessarily putting into things. Could you just trace that out a bit for me?
Yeah, well, that's a bit of a passion. I hope I don't speak too long, but it's certainly a frustration of mine. One thing that I learned in many things that I've learned from Athiona, one's been fantastic, is about actually how we can take a very simplistic approach to actually practically having an impact on carbon. And what we have done for a number of years now is measure our carbon every project, every month. We've got better at actually measuring that in a way that was more general and is quite specific, and I think very well done now, not very hard. And we charge ourselves a carbon tax, and we pay money to a fund that's a central fund globally in Athiona, and then we use that money to draw upon it for R&D projects to try and decarbonise. So it's a disincentive, like it's incentive to not use carbon, and then it's an incentive to draw back out of the pool to actually use that to. And I go, you know, I've been talking about this. Why can't, you know, Victoria, New South Wales governments, all the governments around Australia are the biggest consumers of carbon via us, mainly, as construction companies. And no one talks about it. You know, it's easier to throw rocks at a coal-fired power station. But the truth is, the consumers of carbon is where I think you've got to attack the problem. Because otherwise, you can think you're doing a great job, but if you're still buying steel and no one's measured the carbon content of the steel and you shut down some terrific low-carbon coal out of the Hunter Valley, then if that steel could be being made from poor quality coal, you're actually increased the carbon in the steel that you're buying for your infrastructure project. Mm-hmm. And they're not even taking that into account. So it's like, can you just get back to logic? And now we're seeing New South Wales has now come up with a standard. The other states have agreed to adopt the same approach to measuring carbon. Well, can they get to the point of charging themselves that? Then that goes hand in hand with design. And I think most of the design, and there's no trouble with Australian designers, right? So Australian engineers are as good as any engineers, no doubt in my mind. Our education system, there's no problem with Australian engineers. There's also no trouble with Australian engineering firms, and we work with all of them. But I believe that just like we have got to look at our processes, I think engineering firms need to really look at their processes and governance, and equally, how does that parlay with the commercial contract that we're prepared to enter into, and we as Athiona are saying, we don't want you to take on some of the risks you thought you had to in the past. I want you to work with us to try and get more sharp designs, to try and drive the cost out, to try and drive the carbon out. So I want you to be incentivized to work with us to do that rather than go and take all the risk. And then the other part that I'm told about, I'm no expert on this, and I sort of just mention it cautiously, is about Australian standards, but I'm told that they have got a lot more conservative things like, a bridge parapet. What used to be allowed as a crashing barrier is now 30 times more than it was. Have we had any failures? No. But, how are those things creeping in? How are we really got standards that are appropriate? Are contracts coming in where they're relying on standards that they shouldn't be relying on from other jurisdictions and so forth? We're a very moderate climate. We don't have the, negative 30 to positive 50 that some places do. So, we shouldn't have. We have some other issues, especially in Queensland with resilience and floods. But, I think there's. We can't just sit here driving up this cost like we are, and on a global scale, be so far more expensive than other places in the world, and not really take this seriously about what are we designing, how is our process to going about it, how's our checking, what is the risk. You think about a railway line or a tram line on the ground, you can hardly get a lower risk. Sydney Light Rail, 500 thick concrete. The trams line in Melbourne is 250 thick. We went away from a good design and went to Europe to pick up a design out of Europe and couldn't move from it. It was ridiculous. Complete waste, which then causes us to go down and dig deeper, which hit utilities.
And embody a huge amount more carbon than the concrete you poured. Just to combine the themes of productivity and carbon, do you think there are opportunities in a more carbon-constrained world to use that as a stalking horse for more efficient delivery?
Absolutely. Because surely when they're measuring productivity and they say, well, a bridge 20 years ago cost X and now cost Y, so that's surely how they come up with productivity in our industry, right? Well, if the bridge, it's the same bridge, but uses twice as much concrete, which then takes twice as long to pour, it goes to productivity, doesn't it? So it all comes together.
If only it was so easy, eh?
I think under no illusion will we move to the extent that we could in a short period of time. But if you take a 2% step and another 2% step, if the leaders talk about it more and are genuine about it and say, that makes sense, and let's actually have this desire to move that way, and absolutely we want good governance, and absolutely we want things built safely and appropriately, but let's test everything all the time against the paradigm so that we don't just continue to build process and put another process in place when...
But a price on carbon would give you that opportunity to see where,
well, I think it would help.
You can do it most efficiently.
I think it would be, in addition to that practical issue, I think what you're asking is, will it also have a secondary benefit of helping to drive actually we can become more productive, I believe.
Yeah, I just think a price on carbon allow, it gives you a single number that tells you where to best focus your effort.
Yeah.
As well, which makes it more efficient.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
We've come to the end of the time we have available, but we always ask our guests one question.
Without notice.
Unless you listen to the other 30 episodes, but without notice. We always ask, what's your favourite sort of infrastructure and why?
What's my favourite sort of infrastructure and why? It's been an unusual answer. I'll probably go back to foundations, and foundations are in most infrastructure. It's sort of in my bones. Weirdly enough, it was never going to be going into arts and economics at university, but the truth is, I think it's fascinating. It requires you to really understand geology and the ground conditions. It's different wherever you go, and it's the foundations for all good projects. You get it right, and everything else will go well after that.
We haven't had foundations before.
No.
So is there a particular type of foundation?
It's not a particular class.
Well, you're asking me to say railway lines or tunnels or something?
Say so what's in your heart to say.
Yeah, you can. It's freedom for the question. What do you have a particular type of foundation? Is it piling? You really like?
Oh no, but all of it. Yeah, we've done grouting on dams to make sure that then the water doesn't get under the dam. And you go, how important is that? And in the we're doing a desalination plant in Perth, and we've got a massive big pit that then the tunnels will go out into the ocean from there, and that'll be where the water draws up. And we've just done a huge secant pole wall down to 30 metres, and it's been excavated out, and it's beautiful and waterproof and comes up nicely. And I know how specialist the work is and the equipment that we buy, and I used to actually go to Europe and go and buy it myself. I'd enjoy doing that. I'm going to China in a few weeks' time to see our two tunnel boring machines that we're bringing over the Western Harbour Tunnel for the factory acceptance test. So you never know. I might fall in love with tunnel boring machines.
Have you named them yet?
No, I don't think we have. But, I will have an affinity, because I think tunnelling is sort of very similar to piling, except horizontal instead of vertical.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of similarity there.
I think it's quite fitting, given where we started with the origins of the business back in the 70s being in the ground, that your favourite infrastructure is playing in the dirt. So, Bede Noonan, thank you very much for spending some time with us today. It's been fascinating.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you.